Happy New Year! This is a 2026 special edition of the Mardler magazine. Hello, you're listening to The Mardler, the weekly talking newspaper for North Norfolk, dispatched to you on the 2nd of January, 2026. We're not able to bring you the news today due to the New Year holidays, so we've put together a special magazine edition. A few of our volunteers have submitted their own personal choices of articles, which have been knitted together in the break between Christmas and the New Year. My name is Chris Wilson, and as chairman here at the Mardler, it's my privilege to present this special edition. A little later in this edition, you will hear a whole host of familiar voices, and a few new ones too. But first, on the notice board today, the Mardler trustees, liaison team, roving reporters, editors, sound engineers, readers, copiers and dispatchers all trust that you have had a joyous festive season and wish you the best of health and happiness for the year ahead. We would like to make a special mention for our longest-serving listener who joined the Mardler in December 2005. Happy 20th anniversary, June from Skeighton. This week, the sun will rise around 8:05, and will set around 4:05. And so, with the thought that no news is good news, let's get started with our magazine articles.
Hello, my name is Adrian Allenby, and my story is about one of the greatest tales of escape and survival that happened early in the last century. I am often reminded of it, especially at this time of year, for reasons I will tell you later on. Escape from the crushing powers of frozen ice and survival of the crew of the Antarctic expedition ship Endurance, that was travelling south with a transantarctic polar expedition, whose leader was to be Sir Ernest Shackleton. In August 1914, Shackleton set sail from England on board Endurance, bound for the island of South Georgia in the South Atlantic Ocean, arriving in early December. This was to be the last port of call before reaching Antarctica. On 5th of December 1914, the ship and expedition members set sail from Grytviken Harbour in South Georgia. It was perhaps a bad year for sea ice, and the ship was in the ice some 2 days later. By mid-January, the ship was totally locked in the ice and unable to move. All they could do was to drift along with the movement of the ice pack. By 10 months later, the huge pressure of the ice was beginning to take its toll on this wooden ship. There was little that could be done other than to abandon the ship as it broke up and unload as many stores onto the ice floes as was possible. In the third week of November 1915, the ice consumed the ship and she sank, leaving 29 men, 49 dogs, 10 working sledges, and 3 boats on the solid ice. There was little hope of any rescue. Radios did not exist, and no one else in the whole world knew of the crew's dilemma. They were some 350 miles from the nearest point of land, but no people. The crew decided to haul the boats across the ice until open water was found. No mean feat, with the men getting weaker and weaker as time went on. In early April 1916, open water was accessed, the boats launched, rigged with jury sails, and they sail for a tiny island some 100 miles to the north, known as Elephant Island, remote and uninhabited. 10 days later, after a very hazardous and dangerous voyage in stormy seas, they reach their destination and set up camp in a tiny cove. The nearest possibility of any rescue still lay 800 miles away in South Georgia. Their only hope was to take one of the boats and sail for there. Shackleton left 5 days later, taking 5 men with him in a 20-foot boat. The remainder stayed on Elephant Island, with the frightening thought that they would never know if Shackleton had made it. He did, and after a 2.5-week voyage in mountainous and dangerous seas, they landed on the west side of South Georgia Island. However, all the whaling stations and hopes of rescue lay on the other side of the island. Shackleton decided that there was no way of sailing there, and the only hope was to cross the island on foot. But South Georgia has a backbone of mountains many hundreds of feet high, and these were in the way. A route through would have to be found. A week later, after some surveying of possible routes and some time in which to rest and build up strength, Shackleton set off with 2 other men. The other 3, 2 of whom were far from fit and well, stayed behind in their makeshift camp. After a very exhausting and hazardous trek through the mountains and over the glaciers of South Georgia, at 6:30 one morning, as Shackleton later wrote in his diary, "We heard the first sound caused by an outside agency since December 1914. It was now May 1916. It was the steam whistle from the whaling station in Stromness Bay. The 3 managed to scramble down the last stopes and enter the station, much to the bewilderment of those living there. 2 little boys set eyes on them and ran off terrified. But they met the station manager, who took them under his wings and began to organise boats to attempt rescues of the 3 men left on the other side of South Georgia and those on Elephant Island. However, finding a ship suitable for getting to Elephant Island through any ice floes took longer, and it was not until the end of August 1916 that a ship could reach Elephant Island and all the men were rescued. All those who had stood on the ice floe and watched their ship Endurance sink nearly a year before were rescued, and the only casualty, apparently, was a frostbitten big toe. With no wireless, they were unaware that the war was still going on, and most of them went on to do their bit for king and country. Shackleton vowed to return one day to Antarctica, and he did, arriving in Grytviken Harbour on board another ship in September 1921. Sadly, whilst in Grytviken, shortly after the new year of 1922, he suffered a massive heart attack and died. At the wishes of his wife, he was buried in the small cemetery in Grytviken Harbour. Why am I reminded of this at this time of year? Grytviken Harbour is the site of an abandoned whaling station and today is the administrative headquarters of South Georgia and a British Antarctic Survey base. It is also the site of a beautifully maintained wooden church that originally started life in Norway before being shipped to Grytviken and rebuilt there. I was on board the Royal Navy ship HMS Endurance in 1980, and we were anchored in the harbour on Christmas Day. Our captain led a Christmas Day service in the church, with about 100 of our crew members attending. We prayed and we sang carols, with the church's organ still working, and we thought of our families many thousands of miles away at home. It was a service to remember. With Shackleton's grave a short way away from the church, this is why I am reminded of this epic tale of escape and survival at this time of year.
I am Imogen Waterson, and I have chosen to read a passage from the third chapter of a delightful and heart-rending book called Sea Change, an Epic Poem by Jessica Streeting. The poem is about a family's move to Norfolk following the clergyman father's dream, and the happiness that followed initially, and the subsequent tragedy and reaction to loss. Another place. Dad dreamt that he sailed to an island, somewhere easterly, somewhere watery. An angel-like figure had pulled his boat in and led him up the beach. A gate led from a vast church Dad did not know to a beautiful old house and wild garden. "You will bring your family here," someone had said, possibly God. And then Dad had woken, a warmth and a promise staying with him all day. "As the best dreams make you feel, you know, children?" "Yes, Dad." And the strangest thing, we sat round his strong handmade table as he cupped his big hands round his beer. The extraordinary thing, when the bishop was showing me, when we walked down the path together, before we went into the church and looked up at the angels, I saw porch to the right and the gate to the left. Norfolk angels wear feathery breeches, you know. Do they, Dad? Like the Wombles? Not unlike. But after that, Dad explained, we walked through a gate into a beautiful garden, and the strangest thing was it was the garden, the gate, the church of my dream. Do you see? It was not an island. Sea did not lap at the shore, but in all other ways it was just like my dream. And Norfolk is rather cut off, not unlike an island. He had tailed off at this with a swift glance at Mum, who we knew felt cut off already. How would Mum feel for this strange, watery island of Norfolk? But Mum listened calmly, with no annoyed blink. Our hearts rose, as they do when your parents seem suddenly unencumbered. Mum said, coming home in a way. Did you know that Gar's family all came from Norfolk, a market town, Swaffham? For me, it would be like returning, she smiled. Dad had nodded encouraged. There are churches with hammer-beam angels all over the county. Swaffham, less striking than Corston, perhaps. Those angels? He reached for Mum's hand and she took it. 15th century, untouched and quite lifelike. He laughed, his eyes happy. Were the angels the same as your dream? Asked my sister. The strange angel who brought you to the shore? Our parents had smiled at that too, in that good way that happens when both parents love something you've said. That's a thought, said Dad. Possibly. I couldn't look closely and hadn't much time. They are so far up, high in the roof of the church. Such a building! Dad beamed and threw out his hands wide. A great Norfolk barn of a place, full of faded medieval glory. I heard hammer-beaming angels strike in my head. Come to Corston! Upkeep? Mum raised half an eyebrow. Harder than Hitchin. Hitchin was another parish they had been to consider. They had returned saying, Hitchin's well healed, whatever that meant, and with none of the joy Dad was showing tonight. Upkeep? Yes, a challenge, said Dad. But the village of Corston is thriving. There's a lovely small school. I met the headmaster, whose name, most incredibly, is Kett. Why most incredibly, Dad? Robert Kett led the Norfolk Rebellion. Oh, those angels were carved even earlier. So many revelations in one evening, with our toast and Marmite, allowed to stay up until Dad was home. We had sensed much at stake. Will we move to Corston now? After your dream, Dad? After the angels? Asked Alice. Well, yes. If the bishop and mommy agree, then we might. Hooray! A little sister and I caught the joy, danced off in our nighties, barefoot, round the one straggly rose bush.
I am Merlin Waterson, and I've read for the Mardler for some 20 years. Who better to send a Christmas message which brings a smile than Edward Lear? I have loved his complete nonsense verse since I was a child. Then in my teens, I encountered his brilliant, evocative watercolours and oil paintings, many made on his travels to Greece, Albania, Italy, Corsica, Egypt and India. He was much loved by his friends, but there was a tragedy which explains his incessant travelling. He was an epileptic and suffered from chronic asthma at a time when that made marriage virtually impossible. So there is an undercurrent of sadness in even his most absurd and amusing poems. Here is his self-portrait of the Laureate of Nonsense. How pleasant to know Mr. Lear, who has written such volumes of stuff. Some think him ill-tempered and queer, but a few think him pleasant enough. His mind is concrete and fastidious. His nose is remarkably big. His visage is more or less hideous. His beard, it resembles a wig. He has ears and two eyes and 10 fingers, least ways if you reckon 2 thumbs. Long ago he was one of the singers, but now he is one of the dumbs. He sits in a beautiful parlour with hundreds of books on the wall. He drinks a great deal of Marsala, but never gets tipsy at all. He has many friends, laymen and clerical. Old Foss is the name of his cat. His body is perfectly spherical. He weareth a runcible hat. When he walks in a waterproof white, the children run after him so, calling out, "He's come out in his nightgown, that crazy old Englishman, oh!" He weeps by the side of the ocean. He weeps on the top of the hill. He purchases pancakes and lotion and chocolate shrimps from the mill. He reads but cannot speak Spanish. He cannot abide ginger beer. Ere the days of his pilgrimage vanish, how pleasant to know Mr. Lear. And now, incidents in the life of my Uncle Arley. Oh, my aged Uncle Arley, sitting on a heap of barley through the silent hours of night, close beside a leafy thicket. On his nose there was a cricket, in his hat a railway ticket, but his shoes were far too tight. Long ago in youth he squandered all his goods away and wandered to the Tiniscoop hills afar. There on golden sunsets blazing, every evening found him gazing, singing, "Orb, you're quite amazing, how I wonder what you are." Later in his morning rambles, he perceived the moving brambles, something square and white disclose. 'Twas a first-class railway ticket, but on stooping down to pick it off the ground, a pea-green cricket settled on my uncle's nose. So for 43 winters, till his shoes were worn to splinters, all those hills he wandered o'er. Sometimes silent, sometimes yelling, till he came to Borley Melling, near his old ancestral dwelling. But his shoes were far too tight. On a little heap of barley died my aged Uncle Arley, and they buried him one night, close beside the leafy thicket, there his hat and railway ticket. There his ever faithful cricket, but his shoes were far too tight.
Hello, my name is Sonia. I'm not a real person, just a computer-generated voice. Today I am going to read an item from the BBC Future Earth newsletter published on the 23rd of December, 2025. The article contains a picture of sea squirts seen against an orange, rocky background. They are mostly transparent and cylindrical in appearance. Clustered in a group of about 20, their blue-rimmed open mouths float upwards in the seawater. Many sea squirts are surprisingly beautiful, but they deserve notoriety because of their iconic life choice. They eat their own brains. Sea squirts begin life as tadpole-like swimmers, wide-eyed and equipped with a notochord, a kind of protospine that makes them our distant cousins. They spend their youth, a day or two at most, cruising the oceans in search of the perfect spot to settle down. Once they find the one, a rock, not a mate, sea squirts are hermaphrodites, they glue themselves on head first and begin what must be the most dramatic, I'm done moment, in the animal kingdom. First, they absorb their twitching tail, their primitive eye, gills, and that spine-like notochord. Finally, because why stop there, they consume their own tiny cerebral ganglion, that once guided their adventurous larval phase. That's because, at this point, the sea squirt no longer requires a brain. It has officially retired to a life of peaceful, sedentary snacking. It has become little more than a stomach, with a mouth at one end and what you might politely call an exit tube at the other. Water flows in, food gets filtered, and the rest flows out again. But the weirdness doesn't stop there. Despite their alien appearance and propensity for shooting jets of water when disturbed, sea squirts really are our distant relatives. We parted evolutionary ways roughly 550 million years ago. While our human lineage went all out on complexity, sea squirts committed to minimalism. They shed genes, organs, and basically anything that felt like clutter to achieve one of the simplest genomes among chordates. That doesn't make them less evolved. With over 2,000 different species thriving in oceans all over the world, you might argue sea squirts are smashing it. And they may one day smash their way onto your Christmas dinner plate. The animals are already farmed in some Asian countries. Now a Norwegian company, Pronofa, is aiming to create a mass market for their meat. It is farming a Scandinavian sea squirt in Swedish fjords. The creatures obligingly attach themselves to ropes, grow with zero feeding, simply dining on whatever drifts by, and even tidy up excess algae in the summer. The company harvests them by pulling up the ropes and processing them with rapeseed oil and flavorings into something it claims resembles minced beef. According to Chief Executive Officer Hans Petter Olsen, while scouting for sustainable protein sources, sea squirts won because the process is so incredibly cheap, as well as very low carbon. Olsen tells me their minced product, named Purply, sells for around £7 per kilogram in Scandinavia, making it far cheaper than beef. It is also estimated to produce at least 20 times fewer greenhouse gas emissions. And top of Olsen's New Year to-do list is expanding into other European markets, including the UK. So, if you find yourself carving a sea squirt roast in a few years, don't be surprised. After all, nothing says Christmas spirit like a creature that perfected the art of switching its brain off for the holidays.
Hello, my name is Chris Wilson, and I'm going to read an excerpt from a book entitled Motorcycle Cavalcade. Written by Canon Basil H. Davies, this was published in 1950 and recalls his experiences as a pioneer motorcyclist in the early 1900s. If by some miracle the motorist of 1950 could be transported in time back to 1900, he would instantly realise that if our roads today are inadequate, a very great deal has been accomplished. 50 years ago, the average English road was far more attractive from one aspect only. It often composed a long green aisle, arched with foliage, presenting an ever-changing vista of loveliness and mystery. Its hedgerows were brilliant in spring and summer, with wild flowers of a myriad hues and perfumes. Modern speeds were naturally impossible, for around any of the numerous corners the road might be blocked by a flock of sheep or a drowsy wagoner nodding over his reins. Speed was also extremely uncomfortable, as the surfaces were never smooth. Repairs were not undertaken until the surface had been hammered into a condition that would hardly be tolerated in rural lanes today. The roads of 1900 were very much narrower than those of today. Traffic was not only comparatively lighter, but it was also leisurely in its pace. When two vehicles met, it was at a speed which allowed plenty of time to pull in towards the hedge. Very few vehicles exceeded an average speed of 6 or 7 miles an hour. When I left my gate on a primitive motorcycle, I entered a rural highway of considerable local importance, a typical main road of an agricultural county, far better than the secondary roads of the district. Its width averaged about 12 feet between hedgerows. Its surface consisted of water-bound macadam. Three separate excoriated tracks became visible very soon after each resurfacing. The middle lane was hammered out by iron horse hooves and was visibly punctuated at very brief intervals by the greeny-brown stains of horse droppings in various stages of decay. To each side of this interminable stain, the iron tires of the two-wheeled cart had already begun to disintegrate the macadam. Along both edges of the road, a similar process was soon launched by drippings from the boughs overhead. Some readers will still recall the appalling condition of most British roads at the 1918 armistice. Although, by 1914, road surveyors had begun to build much heavier foundations beneath most roads. By contrast, our 1939 roads withstood the heavy traffic of the Second World War in quite exemplary fashion. But at the dawn of the century, when a road required resurfacing, it was common practice to dump 6 inches of fresh road metal full width across the worst sections. As the county was content to employ only a few road gangs, and to make shift with the minimum number of steamrollers, long periods might elapse before this new metal was rolled in and smoothed over with watered mud. Every main road displayed huge heaps of unbroken stone at intervals along its turf fringes. It is easy to imagine the sensation and the curses with which a pioneer motorcyclist met an unrolled strip of new-laid metal extending clean across the run-up to a steep hill. Town and city streets naturally differed vastly from the open roads in 1900. Some wood paving existed in the smarter areas of great cities. Setts were the usual street paving in industrial areas, and cobblestones lingered in small country towns. Wood paving was highly prized by most road engineers of the period, but could become extremely slippery when filmed with slight moisture. High-speed cornering was quite a special experience in those days. The recklessness of youth, then as now, provided speed temptations that were even less resistible than today. If the visibility ahead permitted us, and even when it should have restrained us, we went into a corner fast on the line of the middle road. The springless front fork began to hop and bob on the corrugated surface, scarred by horseshoes and iron tires, so that the machine was progressing with its front wheel spasmodically airborne. Hurled off course, we found ourselves jerked across to the outside of the curve. since tree drippings had already broken up the rough finish that the road maker had left, the unlucky rider now found himself with the machine threatening to go out of control. Occasionally, the combination of all these handicaps caused the hapless rider to run out of road.
Hello, Ellie.
I'm Beverly from Mardler, the talking newspaper.
Thanks for inviting me here to talk to us about Hillside in West Runton. Perhaps you'd like to tell us all about it and what your role is here.
Hello, thank you for coming. My name's Ellie Farrow and I work at Hillside Animals Sanctuary in West Runton, and I've been here 26 years and I'm on the small animals section. Hillside at West Runton has been going since 2008 when it took over from the Norfolk Shire Horse Centre, which many of your listeners may remember as run by David and Jonquil Bakewell, and they had the heavy horses and the riding stables. They retired in 2008. David sadly passed away very recently, but he had been enjoying a very lovely retirement, well earned. And Hillside is still going, the same premises, but we take in a lot more animals now, although we do have a lot of heavy horses.
I could see some of them, it's lovely.
We're sitting on the heavy horse yard in the sunshine, and the horses are in the stables just behind us, and we can hear them snuffling and munching their hay.
Has it just been feed time then?
It has. We've got one horse who's a little bit underweight when he came in, so he gets an extra feed. And then everybody else has got their hay nets and they're happily munching away on them.
And what sort of animals have you got?
Oh, it's just not just horses at the Shire Horse Sanctuary. We've got all sorts, all rescues. We've got the heavy horses, and then we've got all sorts of other horses as well. Ponies, donkeys, mules, llamas, alpacas, pigs, sheep, goats. We've got rescued deer as well.
Oh.
Mostly muntjacs, but we've got a couple of Chinese water deer as well.
Lovely.
And then there's lots of little animals, like the rabbits, guinea pigs, chickens, ducks, geese, swans.
And are some of them petting? Can visitors come and pet them? Yeah.
Yeah, many of the larger animals will come over for a fuss and a cuddle. One of our sheep, especially Heath, loves a fuss. If you ever want to hug a sheep, he's your man.
Hug a sheep. Brilliant.
Some of the smaller animals aren't so keen on being picked up and cuddled, but they'll often come up to the wire and you can put your fingers in and give them a little stroke.
Nice. I read recently, and actually you've got a poster out the front there, about a bull that was rescued.
Oh, Liam.
Your founder, Wendy Valentine, drove down in the early hours to collect a bull. What's that all about?
The poor boy, we think he'd escaped from an illegal backyard slaughterhouse. He'd made a bid for freedom and was running around the streets of Birmingham.
Sensible animal.
Yes. Thankfully, they managed to catch him, and they took him back to our main sanctuary in Frettenham, near Norwich, where he's now been paired up with a friend who also was rescued in very similar situation.
Oh.
And the two of them have made good friends, and they're now out having a lovely life together.
Oh, how nice. That is really nice. And tell us a bit about the cafe.
Oh yes, so here at Shire Horse Sanctuary we have a little cafe with sort of snacks, drinks, things like that, and it's all animal friendly. So there's no dairy, no eggs, and obviously no meat, because we're a sanctuary.
Absolutely.
But we try and give everybody something, so sweet things, savoury things, and of course you get your tea and your coffee.
Uh-huh, yeah, we've enjoyed that.
And an ice cream.
And an ice cream, lovely. And what's your favourite bit about the Hillside?
Oh, that's a tricky one. You can't beat a cow cuddle.
A cow cuddle.
But also, I really like working outside.
Yeah.
Just
and in winter?
Winter can be a bit hard. We do get very muddy here, but all you need is a good coat and a good pair of wellies.
Definitely.
And you're set. I love it. Being in Norfolk as well, and we've just got such a lovely area here. We have a big pond with lots of rescued ducks and geese on it, but we also get a lot of wild birds come down.
Yeah, I bet.
So it's really nice to listen to the birds and just the smells of nature out there.
It does you good.
It really does.
When we used to come up for holiday, we brought the children here. My grandchildren love it. I have to say, we still come. But there was a charge. You don't charge anymore? What's that all about?
We don't. So back during COVID times, we couldn't open all our indoor areas. And so we felt it wasn't fair to charge full price. So we dropped the charge and just let people come in, give a donation. And it actually worked out really well because we don't get charged VAT on donations, but we did on admission. So this way, all the money goes back to the animals.
Fantastic. Yeah. And do you get good donations?
We do. Yeah, brilliant. Yeah, especially people on holiday. If they want something to do for an hour, they come here. Or people with lower incomes or not much money to spare, you can still come in and you can still cuddle an animal.
And you can come and go, can't you? That's a nice thing. If you've paid for something, you feel you need to stay for more than an hour, whereas if you just, if it's a donation, you just come and have a coffee or whatever.
Exactly, nice. Many people just come in, meet their friends, have a day out with the dogs or the children.
Yeah, and it's dog friendly.
It is, yeah. Dogs on leads are very, very welcome. And don't worry if they bark. Most of the animals here are absolutely fine with dogs.
They accept him.
They do. Brilliant. By the time the dogs have got halfway round, they usually barked out anyway.
Brilliant, brilliant. And my grandchildren love the children's playground. That's a new addition, isn't it?
That has been here for a few years, but over the years it's been updated a bit. But kids absolutely love that. And bigger kids too. I've been known to have a go on the swings still.
Fantastic. Well, Ellie, thank you very much for telling our listeners all about Hillside. And
you're very welcome.
Let's hope some of them come and visit.
Oh, please do.
Perfect. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Hello, my name is Richard Preston and I'm one of the Mardler's sound engineers. What follows is a brief insight into the role of the sound engineer. About 90 minutes is the length of a typical edition of the Mardler. To produce these 90 minutes of content, the editor, four readers and the sound engineer will be together in the recording studio for just over 3 hours. The editor will already have spent a considerable amount of time the previous day putting the reader's scripts together. And after the recording is completed, the sound engineer produces a master copy and passes it to the dispatch team, who then make the 100 or so copies that are posted out to you, the listener. But let's focus on the 3 hours that the production team spend in the studio to create the 90 minutes of content. Why does it take so long, you are probably asking yourself? Listener satisfaction is our goal, and making a faultless 90-minute recording at the first attempt is a challenge. In any live recording, there will always be glitches, stumbles, mispronunciations, and off-microphone noises that need to be corrected. To do this, the sound engineer must work their magic, and that accounts for most of the additional time. Readers come in diverse sizes and gender, and the tone and volume of their voices may vary significantly. The first challenge for the sound engineer is to do a sound check to ensure that each reader's microphone is correctly positioned and that controls on the mixing desk are set to the correct level to compensate for the differences in the readers. Get this right and you, the listener, won't have to keep fiddling with the volume knob on your player when listening to the recording. The mixing desk also is a bit of kit that allows the sound engineer to switch from one reader's microphone to another during a recording and to fade music in and out. Headphones connected to the mixing desk let the sound engineer hear what's happening, but more importantly, the mixing desk is also connected to a computer which shows a visual trace of the sound being recorded in a bit of software called Audacity. Now, the studio protocol is that if a reader in mid-flow stumbles, they should pause a moment and then resume their reading from a point before the stumble. During this time, the recording is still live, and Audacity lets the sound engineer add a marker on the visual trace at the point where the stumble occurred. We stop the live recording after about 15 minutes to allow the sound engineer to review what's been done so far. This pause allows the sound engineer to trawl back through the visual trace to locate the various markers, use the Audacity software to delete the bits of the recording that went wrong, and then save a stumble-free piece of audio. In fairness to the readers, not all errors are theirs. It has been known for a sound engineer to open the wrong reader's microphone, fade in the music earlier than it should have been, or mutter something in the background that gets picked up on the reader's microphone. These sound engineer mishaps, errors, are of course rare. So the first bit of recording, in sound engineering parlance, the first clip, is now perfect. It just remains to record the rest of the week's edition. Usually this will comprise another 6 or 7 clips. Almost inevitably, each will need a bit of tidying up before the team can start recording the next one. This is how the 3 hours is taken up. We are now at the stage where the readers have done their bit, and it just remains for the sound engineer to transform the 90 or so minutes of now, hopefully, faultless recording into something that can be sent out to the listeners. The first step is to export each of the clips from Audacity and save them on the computer as MP3 files. This is the file format that can be copied onto the USB sticks that you, the listener, receive every week. To allow the dispatch team to do their magic, the sound engineer produces 2 master USB sticks, each containing the 7 or 8 clips in MP3 format, and passes them to the dispatch team. It now just remains for the sound engineer to cobble together a single MP3 file of the whole edition and upload it onto the internet, so that it is immediately available for anyone to listen by visiting the Mardler website, that's mardler.org.uk, and clicking on the Mardler Recordings latest edition. Try as hard as a sound engineer might, an occasional glitch can get onto the finished recording that arrives with you, the listener. For this, we can only apologise and hope that you find the occasional glitch amusing.
I'm Sharon White and I'm here in the wonderful Sheringham Museum with a much loved local Sheringham artist, Colin Seal. I know, Colin, you started as a sign writer, but how on earth did you get to where you are now?
Well, it's a long story. When I was a young man, left school, my father was a sign writer. And he'd go around with his box on the bus, on the train. And it was those days he didn't even have a phone. He got a telegram when people wanted to communicate with him. That's how long ago it was. So that was in the 50s, 1950s. In the weekends, I went with him to do sign writing in various jobs, you know, in London, all over the place. Got many buses, trains and what have you to get to the place. And usually work Sundays, because Sunday is when you're painting vehicles and no one's there and everything's more available. So I went sign writing with my dad, and that's how I started. When I left school, I worked for a place called Speedway Signs, and sign writing shop was really, I used to get clipped around the ear when I did it wrong in the sign writing shop. And if we didn't finish it one time, we had to work extra hours. Well, yeah. In the end, I brought them out on strike, and I was only, 18 months after I left school, I was leading this strike, which we won and got back pay and everything else like that. Then I'd done all kinds of work as well as sign writing. When I got married and lived in Newport Pagnell and moved to there, we decided to emigrate to the States where my sister lives. I went to the United States and started to paint not only signs but murals. That's when I started painting murals. And I got to paint murals on buses.
And you did something quite special, didn't you?
Yeah, the buses were called wraparounds, and it means that you can paint on the window. Well, it looks that way, but you can't. What you do is paint on a vinyl. That's not goes on the glass, but all the vinyls got very small holes, very close to each other. About, I think it's 49% holes and 51% vinyl, all very close together. Consequently, you paint on that, and it looks like you can't see the holes. You can see the design continuing from the body of the bus onto there. It looks really nice. But when you're in the bus, you can see outside, just tinted winter. And of course, we've moved to Florida, and that was favourable then. I painted all over the United States and Canada.
And since you've been here, I know you've been involved in so much. You do giant murals, don't you? All kinds of things about the Deep History Coast, and did a special thing, I believe, on, was it a B-12 train?
Oh, yes, I've done it in the bus shelter.
Yes.
Which is going to be knocked down. I'm going to do some more murals on that, Ossendorf Green. Painted a train twice, actually.
Yeah, and you particularly like things to do with the culture and heritage of Sheringham. And you, like, I know you've painted a fishing boat on the floor of the museum, haven't you? And then the Emery family, you did a lovely mural, the boat builders.
In the back of the museum, there was the old boathouse, and on the boathouse, they got a big, on the bottom stage, all they've got is wood. And so where the door used to be, where they used to make the boats, So on that wood, I painted where it used to be the Windsor Rose, which we've got the boat here, that was made by the Emery family with the Emery family members that people recognised.
Yeah.
And that was on ITV and BBC.
Was it? I know the life-size mammoth, which I love, and I think that must be so difficult, the perspective when you're doing such a big thing as that.
Well, there's a job here that I wanted to paint on the wall. It took me 4 years to figure it out. I said we're going to have recycling wood. We had the town council, the mayor, Peter Radcliffe. He got all the scaffolding boards for free. I raised 15,000 quid to finance it all.
Brilliant.
We had to do the engineering, do lots of stuff on it. And we painted the boards separately, not in situ, so we didn't know how they looked until they were put together. I designed it with others. We got paleontologists involved. We got the storyline in. That was definitely a joint thing. And the last part of it, I got cancer again, because I had cancer a few times, but lymphoma. It wasn't the cancer that stopped me, it was the chemo. I started it with a few and I just couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
And you got chemo, it's called chemo fog or something like that. A friend of mine, David, he finished them off and done a really lovely job.
Brilliant.
So, and that's there. So I can really say that it's really part of the community in design and engineering. We had Malcolm Abbs, a big engineering guy. He put it all up for us.
Brilliant.
He'd done it all for free, late.
Yeah.
So it was really a lovely job because the mayor once says to me, so I never thought we could do things so well in the theatre. And we raised our own money, so we didn't get the council to pay us. And we got money over, which I've been doing.
Yeah, all the better.
Now, you did ask me a question about, I said, and I forgot. I said
that's that. All right. It was about your, during lockdown, painting one mural a week.
I know.
And I said, how did that go?
And I said, absolutely not at all. We did mural, but not one a week, maybe two a year.
Yeah.
But I love to.
Well, I'm not surprised having seen the size of some of them.
Yeah, that was, first of all, it takes a week to talk to the person, to plan something, to get them to agree with it.
Yeah.
Because everything you plan, I like to include as much as I can.
Yeah.
And I don't mind people coming in with ideas. I've just done the latest mural I've done for Muselec, which is a twinning.
Yes.
I've done a 6x4 sign that's on the wall, on the prom.
Yeah,
on the west side, and we had a big event to celebrate it, and the French and everything else are going to come down to that. But I didn't design it. I designed the first one. They didn't like it, so they got my friend to do it, Mel Ashcroft, and they loved that. So I said, well, do I paint it? I said, of course I'll paint it. I like it even better. Painting someone else's artwork is harder and more challenging.
Yeah, more of a challenge.
And it's surprising how well it came out. So Mel was so happy with it.
Oh, I bet.
We both put our name to it, as it were.
Colin, it's been a joy talking to you. It really has. And I know we could probably go on a lot longer. But just thank you ever so much for talking to me today.
Hello. My name is Richard Wilson, and I volunteer at the Mardler as a sound engineer, although I'm usually on the other side of the microphone. Today, I'm going to read you a W.H. Davies poem entitled Leisure. What is this life, if full of care? We have no time to stand and stare. No time to stand beneath the boughs and stare as long as sheep or cows. No time to see when woods we pass, where squirrels hide their nuts in grass. No time to see, in broad daylight, streams full of stars, like skies at night. No time to turn at beauty's glance, and watch her feet, how they can dance. No time to wait till her mouth can enrich that smile her eyes began. A poor life this is, if full of care, we have no time to stand and stare.
Hello, my name is Lorna Wilson, and as well as being a reader for the Mardler, I also look after the copying and dispatch of the memory sticks we send out to listeners. With it being pantomime season, I've chosen to read to you today Cinderella by Roald Dahl. I guess you think you know this story. You don't. The real one's much more gory. The phony one, the one you know, was cooked up years and years ago and made to sound all soft and sappy just to keep the children happy. Mind you, they got the first bit right, the bit where, in the dead of night, the ugly sisters, jewels and all, departed for the palace ball, while darling little Cinderella was locked up in a slimy cellar where rats who wanted things to eat began to nibble at her feet. She bellowed, "Help!" and "Let me out!" The magic fairy heard her shout. Appearing in a blaze of light, she said, "My dear, are you all right?" "All right," cried Cindy. "Can't you see? I feel as rotten as can be." She beat her fist against the wall and shouted, "Get me to the ball. There is a disco at the palace. The rest have gone, and I'm jealous. I want a dress, I want a coach, and earrings, and a diamond brooch, and silver slippers, two of those, and lovely nylon pantyhose. Done up like that, I'll guarantee the handsome prince will fall for me." The fairy said, "Hang on a tick." She gave her wand a mighty flick, and quickly, in no time at all, Cindy was at the palace ball. It made the ugly sisters wince to see her dancing with the prince. She held him very tight and pressed herself against his manly chest. The prince himself was turned to pulp. All he could do was gasp and gulp. Then midnight struck. She shouted, "Heck! I've got to run to save my neck." The prince cried, "No, alas, alack." He grabbed her dress to hold her back. As Cindy shouted, "Let me go!" The dress was ripped from head to toe. She ran out in her underwear and lost one slipper on the stair. The prince was on it like a dart. He pressed it to his pounding heart. "The girl this slipper fits," he cried. "Tomorrow morn shall be my bride. I'll visit every house in town until I've tracked the maiden down. Then, rather carelessly, I fear, he placed it on a crate of beer." At once, one of the ugly sisters, the one whose face was blotched with blisters, sneaked up and grabbed the dainty shoe and quickly flushed it down the loo. Then in its place she calmly put the slipper from her own left foot. Aha, you see, the plot grows thicker and Cindy's luck starts looking sicker. Next day, the prince went charging down to knock on all the doors in town. In every house the tension grew. Who was the owner of the shoe? The shoe was long and very wide. A normal foot got lost inside. Also, it smelled a wee bit icky. The owner's feet were hot and sticky. Thousands of eager people came to try it on, but all in vain. Now came the ugly sisters go. One tried it on. The prince screamed, "No!" But she screamed, "Yes, it fits, whoopee! So now you've got to marry me." The prince went white from ear to ear. He muttered, "Let me out of here." "Oh, no, you don't. You made a vow. There's no way you can back out now." Off with her head, the prince roared back. They chopped it off with one big whack. This pleased the prince. He smiled and said, "She's prettier without her head." Then up came sister number two, who yelled, "Now I will try the shoe." "Try this instead," the prince yelled back. He swung his trusty sword and smack. Her head went crashing to the ground. It bounced a bit and rolled around. In the kitchen peeling spuds, Cinderella heard the thuds of bouncing heads upon the floor and poked her own head around the door. "What's all that racket?" Cindy cried. "Mind your own biz," the prince replied. Poor Cindy's heart was torn to shreds. "My prince," she thought, "he chops off heads. How could I marry anyone who does that sort of thing for fun?" Just then, all in a blaze of light, the magic fairy hove in sight. Her magic wand went swoosh and swish. "Cindy," she cried, "come make a wish. Wish anything and have no doubt that I will make it come about." Cindy answered, "Oh, kind fairy, this time I shall be a bit more wary. No more princes, no more money. I've had my taste of honey. I'm wishing for a decent man. They're hard to find. Do you think you can?" Within a minute, Cinderella was married to a lovely fella, a simple jam maker by trade, who sold good homemade marmalade. Their house was filled with smiles and laughter, and they were happy ever after.
And that brings us to the end of this special magazine edition of The Mardler. Our thanks go to the authors of these articles for their contributions. If you have any comments or queries, you can contact our listener liaison officer, Imogen Waterson, on 01263 587 610. Perhaps we should just mention that if you have a smartphone, tablet, or computer, or know someone who has, you can listen to this and other editions online at mardler.org.uk. You can also use an Alexa smart speaker, a variety of smartphone apps, or even a telephone call to listen. Find out the details on our website, mardler.org.uk. We rely on receiving your returned memory sticks and pouches so that we can continue to send you new editions each week. So please remember to return the pouch and memory stick promptly, making sure to reverse the address label first. But keep listening, as immediately following this edition of The Mardler, you can hear items from the Talking News Federation. All of our Mardla volunteers join me in wishing you the best of health, and we look forward to joining you again in a week's time when normal service resumes. But for now, it's...
Cheerio!
DNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hello, my name is Lindsay. I started producing topical items during lockdown to keep my neighbours entertained. All the recordings are made inside my cosy cabin for that extra sense of calm. And naturally enough, I called them Cabin Conversations. I hope you enjoy them. Cabin Conversations about Up Heliar. The Shetland Islands, Scotland, invented the Up Heliar as a Viking-based fire festival, which today takes place annually on the last Tuesday of January, and so will be celebrated on the 27th this year. The dark winter months on a remote Scottish island is said to have bored young military men returning from a somewhat lively Napoleonic Wars. Their desire for some spectacle and daring mischief started the custom of using large barrels of tar from the sailing port, set on fire, then rolled through the narrow streets as the Christmas season ended. Indeed, the title Up Heliar literally means Up Holy Day All. Or perhaps the more long-winded translation, derived from the various Old Norse words, translates as End of Holiday Festival Days for All, and therefore celebrated on Twelfth Night after Christmas. In fact, the Norse word Ufpi, although pronounced differently, does denote the sense of something being at an end, and is still used in Iceland and the Danish-influenced Faroe Islands. Of course, the flaming barrels of tar were less than safe, and was frequently complained about by the more educated among the Shetland Islanders. These took it upon themselves to invent a celebration to satisfy all ages with dramatic historic links to Viking heritage, yet maintaining a more organised structure to the proceedings. They appointed special police constables for the festival and eventually changed the dates to January, forcing a break between Twelfth Night revelry and thus reducing crowd drunkenness. The first Yule torch procession took place in 1876. This torch procession became bigger and bolder for the visit of Alfred, Duke of Edinburgh, who was the second son of Queen Victoria, by starting the tradition of elaborate dressing up in Viking costumes, or guising, to be widespread. Although the guiser Jarl, the chief Viking, was only introduced after 1889. Coincidentally, the same year the wooden galley ship appeared on the scene, a fitting Viking tribute to be set alight and burned as the grand finale. After the First World War, there seemed to be another tweak to the festival, introducing the idea of geyser jarl squads. Modern-day processions are similar to this 19th-century format, with the exception of the overseeing Chief Jarl in Lerwick, who must be on the Up Heliar Committee for 15 years to qualify. Plus, the Jarl squads are now inclusive, accepting women and children. In fact, there has been a whole junior Jarl squad allowed since 1956. They have an early evening torch procession, culminating in the burning of their own Viking longship, all of which is made by the adult committee volunteers. This education in Shetland traditions continues during May to September, where they install the Up Heliar exhibition in the Galley Shed, Lerwick, explaining to visitors the history of the festival. Displays include geyser jarl squad outfits and a short information film. As Jarl squads select a new theme each year, along with producing emblem banner flags, the homemade outfits are remade from September onwards, a huge undertaking when considering the number of participants involved. In 2025, there were 47 YARL squads, made up of 981 guisers, and some of the themes were Wicked, from the musical, Rocking the Jailhouse, Strictly Callum Dancing, presumably named after that year's Chief YARL, Shetland's Got Talent, Alternative Island Games, and even more diverse, Hooray for Monkeys. Once the processions are complete and the torches have set alight the galley replica Viking longships on the water at Lerwick, various YARL squads, junior and adult, disperse to visit halls, schools and other venues in 11 locations across the Shetland Islands, performing their own unique entertainment acts and attending private parties. Indeed, they are probably all vocally warmed up by then, having sung the traditional fire festival songs during all the celebrations. Here's the Oop Heliar song from the Teachers YARL squad, accompanied by the Lerwick Brass Band and with kind permission from Making Waves Records in Shetland, found via www.makingwaves.uk.com. Traditions unite communities in song and celebration for many more years.
Hello and welcome to your regular quiz section. My name is Anne and I have five short questions for you. So if you're ready, let's press on with quiz number 38. The first question is, Halloween originated as an ancient Irish festival. Is this true or false? Question 2. What is the largest Spanish-speaking city in the world? Question 3. What is the world's fastest bird? Question 4. In which country is the Chernobyl nuclear plant located? And question 5. The Parthenon marbles are controversially located in which museum? And that's all for this quiz. I'll speak to you again soon when I bring you the answers. Hello again. This is Anne with your regular quiz section, and I have the answers to quiz number 38. The first question was, Halloween originated as an ancient Irish festival. Is this true or false? Well, it's true, because Halloween has its roots in the ancient Celtic festival of Samhain, a pagan religious celebration to welcome the harvest at the end of summer, when people would light bonfires and wear costumes to ward off ghosts. So now you know. Question 2 was, what is the largest Spanish-speaking city in the world? It's Mexico City. Question 3 was, what is the world's fastest bird? It's a peregrine falcon. Question 4 was, in which country is the Chernobyl nuclear plant located? You'll find it in Ukraine. And question 5 was, the Parthenon marbles are controversially located in which museum?
They're housed in the British Museum. And that's all for this time. I'll speak to you again soon when I bring you the next quiz.
Hello, I am Lindsay, and this article delves into the imagination behind audio-described animation. 60th anniversary of the Magic Roundabout. This animated children's classic TV series was conceived and created in Paris, France, by artists employed by Le Comet Advertising Company, though indirectly as a personal project in the evenings and weekends by some dedicated few led by Serge Dano. The distinct style of this stop-motion animation was cutting-edge for its time, using 3D figures seemingly moving on their own around a spacious cardboard cutout type background scene, unlike the previous traditional glove or string-operated puppets. Le Ménage Enchanté, or The Magical Carousel, had the premise of an elderly owner of this deserted carousel wanting the children to return once more to play, and through the arrival of a magical being, Zebedee, this became possible in the garden. The main girl Florence and her friends, along with Dougal the dog, were established as the regular set of characters. Incidentally, the dog, initially called Polaxa, was not supposed to speak, simply wander on and off screen with the occasional woof, but the French voiceover artist suggested he should have a voice too. One of these breakout group artists was British Ivor Wood, who in later years would leave the newly formed Dano Company to expand his animation skills in England, creating such classics as The Herbs in 1968, Paddington Bear in 1975, and finally in 1981, Postman Pat. Originally, the Magic Roundabout characters were filmed in black and white, but crucially individually voiced in their native language French, which posed a huge problem to the BBC when offered the broadcasting rights in 1964. The BBC was not prepared to dub over the French voices, unlike other countries, as it would have been too expensive. Later, when the BBC revisited this offer, the programme now having proved remarkably successful elsewhere, they approached Eric Thompson, one of the Play School children's TV presenters, to explore an alternative way of converting the episodes into a suitable British format. According to Thompson's wife, Phyllida Law, also an actor, who helped find British names for the characters, he went to a cottage in Scotland with the first couple of animated episodes and their accompanying French written scripts to somehow make this easily digestible for the young British audience. Because Thompson did not know French, he had to rely purely on the visual action on the film played back on a tiny viewer screen and linked to the reel-to-reel film spools. Rather than complicating matters with completely individual voices, Thompson went for a more characterful storytelling angle, as if reading a book to a child. The lines took the form of, "What you doing, old Shaggy?" said Brian the snail. "I'm counting clover leaves, if you must know," said Dougal, sort of narration. Yet occasionally drawing on historic one-liners like, "Florence arrived." "Oh, you've arrived," said Dougal. "And to prove it, you're here." Referencing the radio show Itmar catchphrase. It was even said that Thompson had based his vocal character of Dougal the dog on the mannerisms of the comedian Tony Hancock, known for his slightly dry and gloomy humour. While in contrast,
Brian the snail was energetic and upbeat all the time. Thompson turned out to be the perfect choice to write and calmly voice these intuitive home scripts, combining his talents as an actor, director, and previous choir work by including the odd imaginary song. The Magic Roundabout, now spoken in English, with a uniform UK identity, was broadcast in 1965 by the BBC. Although inadvertently, it also took the role of audio describing the visual action on the TV screen for children and adults' entertainment alike. And widely viewed, having episodes running daily across the working week just before the 6 o'clock news. The before the evening news time slot demanded by Dano as part of the early contract. In fact, when the BBC decided to move the Magic Roundabout programme to an earlier time of 5 to 5, they realised their error. Letters flooded into the junior points of view with extremely negative feedback, surprisingly sent mostly by those adults now missing out on their favourite downtime show, either watching with their children or alone. Several were joint letters, such as from 26 office clerks and 100 angry draftsmen, average age 23, begging the BBC to reconsider their timings. Eventually, after 4 weeks, due to viewers' pressure, the BBC reverted the show back to the normal time slot. Popularity was highest in the UK and particularly grew when the animated scenes with their natural, though bold, colours of reds, blues, pinks and yellows were shown on TV in the 1970s, along with extra animal characters of Ermintrude the cow, Dylan the hippie guitar-playing rabbit, and others. The BBC suddenly realised the value of TV-linked merchandising. Soon the inevitable Blue Peter programme was showing children how to make their very own Magic Roundabout characters, using empty detergent bottles for the base of Dougal the dog, and a ping-pong ball to create the head of Brian the snail. These were not difficult to reproduce with everyday household items, considering that the original animation figure puppets were actually made up of whatever materials had been to hand in the art studio at the time. Zebedee, for example, utilised leftover advert props, a large polystyrene vegetable pea painted red and stuck on top a metal spring. However, like all good things, the Magic Roundabout last episode ended in 1977 in the UK. Though other versions were tried, Dano made a darker-themed feature-length film with the same figures in 1970, which was not well received. Then there was the live stage show in the 1980s with vivid costumed actors, and Channel 4 dug out 52 previously unseen episodes of The Magic Roundabout in 1992, voiced over by the actor Nigel Planer. Lastly, a joint French-UK animation company produced a full digital film in 2005, again with an unsettlingly scary twist, meaning the age of deeply accepted joyful innocence had passed.
DNF Soundings.